Welcome into The Looking Glass, the podcast for speculative poets and poetry lovers alike. Join me, Jasmine Arch, on a journey into a world where nothing is what you expect it to be. Together with speculative poets from across the globe and from all levels of experience, we'll be exploring the magic behind this fascinating genre and hopefully have a few laughs along the way. Greetings, Looking Glass travelers, and welcome to a bonus episode. Because honestly, I interviewed T.D. Walker about two of her other books in episode 2 of this season, and right after we recorded another conversation about her new book, but you're getting it now because the book is out now. So let's just launch into the conversation. If you would like to find out more about T.D., I will link her original episode as well as her website and contact information in the episode notes to this little bonus. First off, Tammy, is there something you want to say about this book?
Yes. And thank you for having me back for this bonus episode. The thing that I wanted to say about this book is it was very much a book that came out of the pandemic. It took a lot of my concerns about what was going on around us. We were sheltering in place, trying to stay safe as much as possible. So it diverged from my previous writing because there is a lot more in this book that is from lived experience, but it is speculative at the same time.
Right. Maybe we should mention the title of the book before we launch in. Do you want to share it with us?
Oh, yes. The title of this book is Doubt and Circuitry, and it will be it is published by Southern Arizona Press.
Okay, that would have been a great place to start, but yeah, structure is not always my strongest trait. So the first thing I noticed when I turned to the first pages of this collection is how much closer to the skin it all sits than the work I read in your other two collections. The sense of building unease, the juxtapositions between sort of that unease and dread and children at play or the mundanity of shopping lists and grocery carts, it makes for something all of us can identify with. Those of us who remember Chernobyl, yes. But for those who don't, I think these poems are, first of all, an excellent example of how a specificity makes for the most powerful images, even if your reader or listener doesn't necessarily have a touching point with that exact and very specific experience. But also, with what we've all been through, I don't think we need to remember Chernobyl to have recollections of dread and how that features into everyday life. But did this change a lot about the, well, you already mentioned the drafting process, but did you go about editing in a different way as well?
For the individual poems, I'll say for the first part of the first two thirds of the book, it didn't, when I write speculative poetry, especially, I do a lot of preliminary work. There's a lot of research that goes into it. I write a lot of notes so that I know where I'm taking the poem and, you know, where the poem can take me and the reader. That said, I'm glad that you mentioned Chernobyl, because I had completed the entire manuscript before Russia invaded Ukraine. And so for those who either don't remember Chernobyl, what happened there, the reactor essentially melted down because of human error that came out of Moscow. So essentially human error, a lot of prioritizing the government and prioritizing their position and their structure and the powers that they had in place over human lives was in play. And that's why that disaster happened. And that's what I wanted to bring in. That poem is I meant for it to discuss COVID in the sense of disasters that are handled in ways that could have saved lives. So I finished that poem, and then Russia invaded Ukraine, which complicated that even more, because once again, we see Russia as an aggressor, having no regard for lives in Ukraine. So I went back and I looked at that poem, and I still feel like that drive to persist even in times of crisis, even though COVID and Chernobyl were very different disasters and affected the lives that were affected in very different ways, there's still that sense that we need to have this greater view into what are governments doing? What are people in power doing? And so I went back and I wrote that coda that acknowledged that once again, you know, you have Moscow essentially endangering the sovereign nation and doing it in such a way that completely disregards the lives of the people there.
Right. Well, I can't imagine how tricky it feels to work about something that is so new and recent and something we're all still sort of coming to grips with. That said, I absolutely loved this collection just as much as I loved your others. One thing that struck me is that in the first part of the book, Cornell read 1960 COVID 2020, is how the opening lines of each section reflect the ending lines of the previous section. And that same pattern returns in the later Chernobyl 1986 COVID 2021 section. It's not always a word for word repetition, but definitely very recognizable. And it's such a great and subtle way to connect all these different images. Where did that come from?
The collection is actually sonnets, but I wanted to present the sonnet not in a very strict way. The poems rhyme, but I wanted that rhyme to sit just under the surface so that,
yeah,
going back to this idea of the music of the lines, it's there, but it's not.
Okay.
That music has to serve the line of the poem, not jamming some ideas into a form. Because I love about the sonnet the idea of the turn.
Right.
And for me, the arguments that I wanted to make in the poem, and really the arguments that I was making with myself, because as a parent, I was definitely arguing with myself during this time. What's the best thing that I can do for my kids as someone who was quite high risk myself. There was a lot of how do we do this? So it my thoughts were quite circular. So I wanted to have that repetition of phrasing as a way of returning. It's also the first two sections of each sonnet, and then the last part are in different voices. So like in Conalrad, the first parts of each sonnet are in the voice of a child who has a radio and is listening to these emergency broadcasts. Conalrad, maybe I can step back and explain what Conalrad is. Conalrad was in the United States a radio alert that was put into place during the Cold War, and it was really for nuclear war. Basically, it was put into place so that people could turn to these two frequencies. There would be a patterned message. You would hear these very specific tones, and then a message would follow, probably go shelter. You know, it was never used because fortunately there was never reason to, and it went away, and evolved into the emergency broadcasting system that we have now. But I was thinking so much about the way that the patterns were put into place for emergency communication around COVID. That's why I brought that in. So all that to say, there were so many patterns in my own thoughts, in the way that we were receiving crisis communication, in the way that crisis communication was created in the past. That's why I wanted to have that sense of repetition in the poems.
Right. Okay, that is, I'm going to have to reread all of that. I often do that with poetry much more than with any sort of fiction, sort of returning to them in a different state of mind. It makes the reading completely different, obviously. So I'm going to ask you a mean question, but I'm going to anyway. I know it's mean. It's like asking a parent which of their children they love most. But I'm gonna ask, which poem in this collection is your favorite?
It's actually a series. It's the harp poems, and harp stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. It was originally created. It's up in Alaska. It's out of the way. It was originally funded by the U.S. military, but it's now run by the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. And it was fascinating to me because HAARP has gathered so many weird conspiracy theories over the years. So I wanted to give voice to the antenna array there to push back at these completely unfounded conspiracy theories that have grown up around the project.
Okay. Well, mine has got to be the penultimate poem in the book, the epilogue in the Chernobyl COVID 2021 cycle, Duga Considers the Future. Because at the end of all that dread building under your skin and raising goosebumps, you get hope of a new beginning, or a sense that no matter what we've been or what we've done, what we were made into, we can start fresh and take a different road. And that's sort of for a very sort of a collection that took me into sort of a dark place in my head. That was a nice way to end. But all in all, this collection feels very confessional, despite the different voices you mix in there. And it's not an easy thing, or it can't have been an easy thing, to balance with the speculative element in there at times. Do you have any tips for listeners playing around with a similar concept, examining their own life, world, or history, or memories through speculative poetry?
Yes. I really just have one, and it's go back to this. What questions are you trying to ask? Because, you know, I could have written about my difficulties parenting, basically when our world was just my family. And, you know, we did what we could, but it was the questions that aligned out of that so well with the questions that I was writing with science fiction poetry that allowed me to bring them together. So my tip for anyone wanting to bring together the personal and the speculative is think about what questions you want to ask. And it doesn't even matter if you can find a satisfactory answer. You know, I think, you know, just going back to what you were saying before this, I was searching for hope a lot during that time. I don't think I was the only one doing that.
I can imagine.
But yeah, so that was one of the questions that I was asking, where do we find hope in the darkness? And that's something that I was trying to do personally, and something that we have to do in speculative fiction, speculative poetry. So go back to the questions that you want to ask and figure out the commonplaces there.
Okay. Thank you very much for that one. It really is a good reminder to have sometimes. Did you want to share a poem from this collection as well?
Yes. The poem that I'm going to read is part of the HAARP series. And I think I'm just going to read this first one. So these poems in the HAARP series aren't situated together in the collection, but they still have that echo. So the last line of the first one is actually the first line of the second one. And then on the fifth one, the last line of that one is the last line of the fifth poem is the first line of the first poem. So you won't hear that here because I'm just going to read the first one, but it's that same idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So this one was first published in Jet Fuel Review. And the quote that the title comes from the FAQ on the HARP website from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And it also begins with a quote from that FAQ. One, are there any long-term effects of ionospheric heating? Quote, a good analogy to this process is dropping a stone in a fast-moving stream. The ripples caused by the stone are quickly lost in the rapidly moving water and are completely undetectable a little farther downstream. From the University of Alaska Fairbanks HARP FAQ. Or instead, say the sea. Say Baroque rock dropped astern. Say, consider the hull of a cruise ship. Consider the tension water maintains as its surface. And then consider breaching that surface. Consider falling through water. Consider movements of fins in water, fins in vocal folds. And consider the algae, the fish, the whales among the shoals. Stone wavelets, undulations faint against receptive skins. Consider the eyes convergently evolved therein. Say the sea. Say Baroque. Say what can be seen, received. Say tentacles of giant squid. Say manatees. Say giant oarfish. Say giant Pacific octopus. Consider failure to capture the wholeness of a being. Say sea-coiffed limb. Say how the stone falls toward the sediment-edged dimness of things. Considered how I too am made monster. Thank you.
Wow, thank you. Obviously, for this poem, but also for coming on and talking to me about all of this, because I absolutely loved the discussion we had, both now and in your original episode.
Well, thank you for having me on, Jasmine.
It's my pleasure. So at the risk of sounding maybe a bit sentimental or dramatic, I'd like to end on something a rather clever poet wrote, and that is, a poem is never the way things end.
Yes.
But actually, that very clever poet is just Tammy herself. But let me just add that while it is not the way things end, it's often the way things begin. Poetry can be an amazing tool to explore both your inner and outer world, find ways to integrate those, and begin to process the experiences you struggle with. And yes, there are other ways to do that, but few of them have as much potential to help others do the same. But that, as they say, is all she wrote. For now, anyway, because Tammy is obviously working on more poetry. This is your friendly neighborhood Jazz and Tammy saying bye. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving a review wherever you get your podcast fix and sharing it on social media or with a friend if you think they'd enjoy it too. One of the best things you can do for your favorite content creators is spreading the word and helping more people find their work. Don't forget to subscribe so our next episode automatically lands in your podcast feed as well. Into the Looking Glass is a joint project hosted by me, Jasmine Arch, and Brittany Hawes. This bonus episode was recorded and produced by Jasmine Arch. Our theme song is Wonderland by Alexander Nakarada.